It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The been thinking about McDonald's all day, can't get it off my mind. I can already taste it. Ooh, got my mind on my mouth and my mouth ready for some Mickey D's deal.
There's a deal for every moment at McDonald's.
Right now, get two of your favorites for just $3.50. Mix and match a classic McChicken, a hot and spicy McChicken, or a juicy McDouble. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal. Single item at regular price.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Well, hello. Welcome along. The show is No Encore. I am your humble, gracious, and highly favoured host, Craig Fitzpatrick. I'm not exactly sure what that description means. I think I just nicked it from Joe Budden. I don't know. I'm not going to start like using gunshot drops or something like that. I won't get too out of hand. If you're wondering where Dave is, well, thanks a bunch. Not enough for you. He's having a well-deserved week off, so get off my back, get off his back, all right? Luckily, Sonic Architect Adam Shanahan is back in the saddle. Unluckily, he has no mic. The only other mic I can see is in a Zoom window marked Zara Hederman.
Hey!
Welcome back.
How are you? It's good to be back.
Great, yeah. After your glorious Paddy's Day show.
I know.
A prompt return.
I know, it's a very quick turnaround. I thought I usually only get one show a year.
You have this feeling that like your shows are rationed or something like that, which is not the case whatsoever.
It's just years of Dave constantly like threatening me that I'm never allowed back on, which we all know is just because he hates
that. Yeah, that's me every week, Zara.
Yeah, I know how you feel, Craig. It's tough. It's tough to be the secret favourite. But look.
Yeah. Yeah, a secret no longer, though.
Yeah, that's it.
Secret favourite, esteemed music journalist. You can read Zara's work in The Quietus. You can read it in Totally Dublin, Loud and Quiet. You'll hear her on Arena. She's everywhere. And at Zara_Hederman, I believe, on Twitter.
The very one.
It's great to have you back. Oh, you did have a kind of bad omen this morning, right?
Oh,
there
my
was
God.
A situation, a wasp situation. Yeah. What was going on? You stormed into our Kylie and Jason teamed WhatsApp group, especially for you, which Adam had actually bailed on, unbeknownst to us, around January. Yeah. What was the situation?
Yeah, I still haven't told Tapley this. So he'll probably just find out on the episode, which is quite funny.
Shout out to David Tapley, friend of the show.
Yeah, big friend of the show. I was about to leave for work today, and I was putting my shoes on, and next of all, I just heard this very alarming buzz sound. And I just thought, knowing me, that I knocked something over. So I was slightly worried that I spilt water or something like that. Then I went further and further towards the buzz.
Yeah.
Craig, it was literally the most traumatizing thing I've ever seen in my life. I saw two spiders, like, yeah, as I described to you and Adam earlier, like burritoing up a massive wasp. Like, massive.
The use of burritoing is sensational.
And then spit roasting the wasp. So about an hour ago when I got home, I checked the window ledge to see if it was still there or not. And it's gone. Yeah, it's gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Short work of that.
Well, there was two
it was
spiders.
Still buzzing, though, as I pointed out. It was still buzzing, so surely...
Well, it wasn't was buzzing. Not... It was not buzzing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
it was... That is just grim on an existential level. We actually had an ant problem in the gaff last week, which was, like, it was substantial. They were coming in through, like, radiators under floorboards.
Oh, God.
We think there was, like, a nest under the porch. So, like, for a few days, I was getting by with that, like, horrific thing of just, like, stomping them and squishing them and then regretting it slightly because, like, you're wiping out a life, a small life, but a life. And eventually, we just had to go for the bomb. Oh. We had to go nuclear. We had to, get this. I think it's called, like, ant stop, exclamation mark, bait station or something.
Oh, God. Sounds like a cool nightclub in Leixlip.
Yeah, or like a dodgy Sky Channel.
Yeah.
Bait station. But, like, yeah, it's this thing of, like, there's food in it, which they love.
Okay.
But it's also, obviously, just completely laden with poison. So it's this awful thing of, like, you're tricking them into poisoning them, and they're like, the worker ants are heading back to their queen with the very thing that will kill her, and it's kind of like, it's got to be embarrassing for
that
them first of
brutal.
All
brutal.
I was like genuinely like googling, are ants conscious, like how much do ants feel? I had a fucking moment where I think it's lockdown getting to me. I was in quagmire, but they're all gone now. They're just they haven't been back. Yeah.
That's quite quick. That's a quick turnaround for the owl ant extinction.
It was ruthless.
You won't be watching Ants then anytime soon, will you? That Pixar film.
Ants the movie with a Z?
Yeah.
I won't. I might go back to A Bug's Life first.
Oh, that's a great film.
And then if I can handle Disney's A Bug's Life, then maybe the harsh realities of Pixar's Ants.
Yeah.
Like, how it worked.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll be fine. Anyway, we need to move on with our lives because there's other fish to fry. Mm-hmm. We've an episode heavy on the spoken word.
Yeah.
So we're reviewing Dry Cleaning, which is a much hyped album with the singular vocalising of Florence Shaw. So we're inspired by that, or more specifically, I saw an old Six Music tweet that inspired me as well. So we're doing our top five like spoken word moments. So this is basically like talking in songs. It can be samples. It can be like full spoken word tracks, melodramatic breakdowns, the lot. So that's coming up. That's our album, our top five. Yeah, it's going to be great, I think. There was a lot of examples out there and kind of very different. We'll get to it. But it was tough to like gauge the impact of like maybe a small little clip over like a longer track, and we'll discuss it. I guess we'll get to the news first. Before that, if you do need your day fix, he has been busy this week. He did a standalone interview with David Balfe of For Those I Love, which you should definitely check out. It's a great interview. Very open, very revealing. Check that out now. It's in your feed. It's just one extra show on this channel. I'm calling it a channel. You can't stop me. You'll find even more, like our monthly No Aux Cord, if you head for our Patreon, patreon.com/NoAncore. And yeah, I guess throw us a small amount, maybe once a month. The choice is yours, but the
it's
time
very
is now.
Deserved.
Thank you, Zara.
It's the best fiver I spend every month, to be honest.
Now there's just no pubs open yet, for sure. Well, we appreciate that. We appreciate you in general. And now it's time for the news.
Hey, you heard about the good news?
Love that sting. It's kind of frivolous, and we're going to start with... a far more serious update, and this is really just an update. We don't really know what the situation is. It's a story that's kind of still developing around DMX, and the latest we have is probably not the latest you have as you listen to this, but last I read, doctors were performing kind of tests around brain function on him on Wednesday to see what state he is in currently. He remains on life support. He's in a coma in a New York hospital. The news broke on Saturday that he'd been taken in. He'd had a heart attack as well. He went for a significant amount of time without oxygen. And of course, DMX, you know, famed rapper, a real iconoclast and just really beloved for a certain generation, probably ours specifically. You know, he broke around the turn of the century and just was like such a kind of huge force in music. He's had his struggles for sure. This is another one of them. Hopefully he pulls true. But yeah, just a sad story, still developing one. There's, you know, been prayer vigils for him. People have, you know, outpouring of well wishes, as you can imagine. But Zara, I don't know if you've been following this one as well. It's kind of a what more can we say situation, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, exactly. It was such a shock on, I think it was like late Friday night, early Saturday morning kind of deal. I found out about it initially because one of my friends in one of my WhatsApp groups, he shared the initial news story when it broke. And I think he was like a pretty big DMX fan and was obviously very sad about the news. It would be just such a shame if, you know, things don't go so well for DMX in this situation. Obviously, it's going to be very tough for him to make a full recovery. But I guess all we can say is wish the best to him, his family, his manager. And I actually, last night when we were going through, when I was going through the news, I started to listen to DMX again, just to like kind of remember what a legend like he is and how great his songs were. I completely forgot about Party Up, and also I completely forgot that it was him, because like I have this thing where I go around the house just going like, you know, y'all gonna make me lose my mind, up in here. So I say it like quite a lot, and even just to myself, like if something goes wrong in my life, and just like just hearing it last night, it made me smile so much, and just made me like feel really sad for him, for his family. And yeah, hopefully we get more news soon on his development.
Yeah, that's a good shout though. It is like, if you hear this news and want to cheer yourself up, the best thing to do is listen to DMX's music, because it's just such energizing, just incredible stuff. If any situation you kind of need a bit of an energy boost, a bit of a confidence boost, DMX is your man. And yeah, as we say, like outpouring of kind of well wishes and people talking about the influence of him. And he's had luckily a lot of that in recent times. Like he seemed to be getting over the worst of his problems, got out of prison. And like just last summer, he was on that Versus show with Snoop, where it's kind of like started as a hip hop thing, where kind of MCs and DJs and producers would kind of battle off with their greatest hits and perform, and you could just see kind of social media reacting, and he seemed to be really, really enjoying it. He was in top form. It was great just seeing, so many hits as well. He was massive. I think you forget that. And he's had a tough time. Like he talked as well, he was talking to Talib Kweli about his early kind of drug abuse, and it started at something like 14. His then mentor, he was talking about, gave him like a blunt laced with crack without him knowing, and he's like, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. So he didn't get off to the best of starts. Like the odds have been stacked against him plenty of times before. Hopefully, you know, he comes good this time as well. So yeah, I guess we'll just kind of keep an eye on that story. Another kind of like, it's not the most upbeat starts in the news, another kind of like hell of the music industry and life in general, and I'm spelling that general with a J, because we're getting Jepic. Jedward have been shockingly all over social media, which I want to do of like, yeah. They've really kind of had a bit of a renaissance for sure. Just taking on great causes, recently shaved their heads, looking very well on it for cancer charities. But they've come for cancer, and now they've come for Simon Cowell.
Oh, Jesus, Craig.
Not comparing the two whatsoever. I'm just saying two separate things in a sentence.
It just sounds like a kind of summer blockbuster hit. Like
this summer. Yeah.
Adam's face is in his hands right now.
In his disco Tesco mimicking t-shirt. Yeah. Downcast. This would never happen with Dave. But yeah, they were really spilling the tea. I think that's what you say. Yeah. And opening up about music industry, specifically the whole X Factor reality show thing, the big machine that like Simon Cowell heads up. And, you know, it kind of started as them saying the biggest regret in life was not telling the judges on X Factor to fuck off. There was numerous tweets about stuff we kind of already know about contestants being akin to kind of slaves to the show. You're not getting paid. They're obviously making millions. There's a lot of tweets in that regard, like, you know, how ridiculous it is that you get assigned a mentor when they don't really care about you whatsoever. Simon Cowell compared to a mafia leader, a bit toned down on what we were going for earlier. One of the tweets was, when in reality he's nothing but a bad facelift.
Quite harsh.
They also specifically went into talking about the situation for One Direction and Little Mix, two huge acts that have come from those shows, and kind of saying that they have seen their contracts. They know that maybe they're not getting the best possible deals. They've gone into, I guess, compromising, like the kind of tweets that I'm guessing lawyers were then poring over, which they acknowledged themselves, and they're like, "Oh, we're here for it. We're not putting up with it anymore." And just got kind of darker and darker, talking about, you know, stories they hear in LA, artists, you know, being on tour and minders being, you know, assigned to them, that is basically just keeping them on the straight and narrow and essentially working, and just kind of the awful stuff they go through. But yeah, they pretty much wrapped with, you know, justice is going to be served, you can't silence the truth, nobody can drag me down, which I was thinking, are they speaking
yeah,
I was like, is, because we always think of them as just Jedward, right, which isn't really fair, because they are John and Edward. I think you can make an argument that that is the case. So I'm kind of thinking, like, did Edward slash John just, like, get on the account and just go on this tear, and, like, because they're finishing with, you know, nobody can drag me down, and then, like, John is like, mate, what have we just done?
Take the login details off him, like, just like, oh god, delete.
What did you make of it?
I found this story, I think initially when I saw it in the running order, I found it funny initially. I thought it was going to be a far lighter story when I saw them saying that Simon Cowell is nothing but a bad facelift. I kind of just initially thought, from that glance, thought that this was going to be just kind of like your classic, like, fuck Simon Cowell, like, rant, which, I mean, obviously we don't have to have had any kind of interaction with Simon Cowell personally to know that he's probably a cretin. But then actually, as I read on and read through the tweets, and there's so many of them, like, there must be at least 30 or so tweets in this. The further you go down on it, the kind of darker it gets. Like, they make some really salient points, I think, about artists' well-being, particularly about, you know, how artists are on the brink of collapse at the end of touring and having to act like everything is okay. Humans can't be owned. Artists shouldn't be owned. And then following that, they say eating disorders and depression are very common in the music industry, and it's because nobody cares about the artist's mental health, only the money. And, you know, I have to commend them for speaking out so forthright about those issues. I think that artists' mental health and well-being is actually only something that's really been taken into consideration by fans, especially in the last kind of maybe 5 or so years, since this, like, dialogue has kind of opened up a lot more. And you have, you know, you have people like Jedward who are within that whirlwind that is the music industry, and, you know, with their strand of it as well as the showbiz kind of side of it. So yeah, I think it's great that they are raising awareness to it. I mean, I don't really know what kind of consequences are going to land on Simon Cowell. I feel that he's probably a fairly protected figure. I mean, there was a point also in that news story where X Factor was on hold anyway because of the pandemic. They had those, like, they had the side shows where it had people from Love Island who were in a band. And but like, it, like, this news story as well kind of reminded me of X Factor, because it's not really something that I have thought about or even really given much time to, you know, considering, other than when I do news stories for the show here, that's when I think about X Factor again, because it usually involves the previous contestants.
X Factor heavy. Yeah. Wow. Need to start looking at that running order. I was slightly torn on like them specifically calling out, say, One Direction and Little Mix and going, you know, because by doing that, they know themselves that they're instantly getting like the stand-em, involved and kind of concerned. And I did see some tweets from fans being like, I hope there's no repercussions for people within those acts. So they did, like, they're smart enough guys, they know kind of how to play the game. I wonder, you know, probably no repercussions for Simon Cowell. I wonder what this means or how the acts in question themselves feel. I've no doubt that they've been, you know, as everyone in the music industry is, somewhat taken advantage of. It's just the way the machine works. I wonder how they felt seeing this kind of outpouring and it kind of taking off a little bit.
Yeah, I do remember at the time of when Zayn released Icarus, and I think that was when he was kind of doing a lot of press and speaking out about how, like, when he left One Direction, he really wanted to step away from music entirely because it had had such a kind of, maybe like damning effect is too strong a phrase to put on it, but he did mention how he did kind of have a bit of a, like, not even, okay, PTSD is also too strong, but he did kind of say that he really struggled with his mental health and his kind of sense of self-worth, I guess, especially being in that group dynamic and especially when it's a boy band like that. But one thing actually that really stood out to me in this, to be kind of nitpicking at Jedward, is the bit when they talk about how the judges need to stop bigging up people and giving them false hope. They need to say it how it is. I remember watching that season of X Factor, and from my memory, I remember that they had, during their audition, they were obviously terrible, but the judges were all like, no, it's a no for me, it's a no for me. And they pretty much, I think, held the judges hostage, and they were like, we're not leaving the room until you give us a yes. Like,
that's, that sounds familiar.
That was my recollection. I was like, well, they weren't bigging up people like all the time because they clearly said no.
Or was it kind of like a popular vote, like people, like the audience was just keeping them in kind of situation?
But it was before that, even like during the audition.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Right.
So that just didn't sit easily with me. But look, I'll give them a pass for that.
Yeah, I mean, they did previously, they were up in arms about Simon Cowell for deleting their legacy, which was their big words. And what happened was their debut single was removed from streaming services. If you forget the debut single, it was that mashup of Under Pressure and Ice Ice Baby. So it's like, I don't know, maybe doing them a favor on that one. Like, I suppose it is their legacy and, you know, it's what they're responsible for, I guess. But yeah, it's a tough call. But I totally agree with the sentiment. And, you know, it chimes with some other stuff that's happening in the industry. Rebecca Ferguson, who also came from X Factor, she's going through more kind of official channels at the moment as well. She's calling for parliamentary action in the UK to overhaul the industry and bullying that she says allegedly takes place, and saying, listen, trying to kind of reconfigure how streaming and payments work is great, but we're not going far enough to talk about kind of artist welfare. And specifically, she wants to get kind of Ofcom involved to launch investigations into these type of reality shows that might be taking people advantage.
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm glad to see that she's doing that. That's good.
So yeah, watch your space, I suppose. We'll see how that goes. Possibly in the not too distant future, we won't need artists at all, and Simon Cowell will be pleased. Is AI coming to save the day? This is a bit of a weird one, right? So an AI software has written new songs by Nirvana, Amy Winehouse, Jimi Hendrix and stuff. It seems like it might just be this kind of algorithm company trying to drum up a bit of PR, but it's actually to raise awareness for the importance of mental health support. So it's this Toronto organization, Over the Bridge. It's a compilation featuring songs created via AI in the style of musicians who died at the age of 27. So part of that kind of much talked about 27 club, and basically saying that that is way too romanticized. They needed help, and wouldn't it be great if they're still around creating, as we can do, kind of, you know, a pass at, an attempt at, by using these kind of algorithms. We've got a little clip of the Nirvana one. It's called Drowned in the Sun. So far, so Nirvana, maybe Stained. I don't know. Let's have a listen.
Now
Yeah. What do we think? Like, there's definitely parts there where I'm like, that's a clear lift from like All Apologies, or I don't know if this is as sophisticated and scary as I thought it might be.
It's pretty dire.
Yeah.
It's pretty dire. And yeah, reading it, reading this news story again, these news stories are just so, so upsetting. This one kind of continued to damper my mood a lot, because while on one hand, I really appreciate that there is an organization that are trying to raise awareness and get rid of the stigma of depression and mental health issues within the music industry, I 100% support that and appreciate it. But I find it just kind of unnerving in the manner that they're doing it, especially when, you know, they're using an algorithm, so essentially software and a computer, an inhuman thing to then generate out of the cloud, a song that they think some artist would come out write and come out with. It just kind of feels a bit like another strand of manipulating an artist and trying to mold
them. It's a weird alignment, isn't it? it's like raising awareness for the suffering of artists by kind of using a tool that probably ultimately will get a lot better and start replacing a lot of the content that people inevitably, it might be a few decades from now down the line, there will be a lot of AI content that is indistinguishable from new music. And that will invariably kind of push people out slightly. So yeah, kind of bad vibes around this story. I mean, I guess it worked in that we mentioned the name of the charity and we're kind of talking about it.
Yeah.
And whereas, if they did a fundraiser, it wouldn't. But
I just love as well, the quote from the guy, Eric Hogan, who's, I think, is he the guy who's behind the creation of the software?
Sure, let's go with that.
Yeah, let's say that. But he's talking about the song, and he goes, "The song is saying, 'I'm a weirdo, but I like it.'" He says, "That is total Kurt Cobain right there. The sentiment is exactly what he would have said. The sun shines on you, but I don't know how. That's great." I don't think that Kurt Cobain would be that optimistic at the end to be like, "The sun shines on you, but I don't know how." I think he would be more inclined to not wish that on someone. Kurt Cobain is pretty terrifying. I remember being 4 years old and just being absolutely terrified of him. So, but
you were
now,
terrified of Kurt Cobain?
Yeah, terrified.
Seemed like a sweet man.
No, he just had nice cardigans.
He did have lovely, comfy cardigans. Photos of him with kittens, you know.
Yeah. No, my brother.
Big glasses.
My brother had a massive poster of him in his bedroom, and it was a really scary up close one. And he used to pretty much lock me in his bedroom when I was by myself, just with this picture of Kurt Cobain staring back at me. So it really put me off.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, tremendous musician.
Yeah.
Nirvana inspired so much dross, though. And this is kind of just adding to it, isn't it, really? Yeah. If you said this was the new single from Stained, I'd be like, yeah, probably.
Absolutely.
But a kind of weird one. Okay, let's get more upbeat. Let's talk about real humans, real musicians taking real drugs with each other. Alice Cooper. Everyone loves Alice Cooper. He's been talking. Sorry, I was just taking a drink there. Not drugs. But no. Yeah, he's been talking a lot lately. I guess he's got an album out or something. Last month he was saying he wanted to be in the Foo Fighters.
So
I don't know what's going on with Alice Cooper. But he's talked about his first experience using drugs, and he was with Jimi Hendrix. He wasn't just hanging out backstage as a fellow musician, however. He says weed was the first drug and was with Hendrix. "I'm sitting there after the show. I went to see them." So at the time he was just in a small high school band, but they said, "Hey, come on up to the hotel room." So he's a high schooler and he just goes to the show, and Jimi Hendrix and the rest of the experience are like, "Hey, are you experienced?" And suddenly they're sitting on his bed, and luckily it doesn't go badly from there. Jimmy just goes, "Here, man," passes a joint, and he went, "Okay." And then this is such a fantastic detail. He goes and puts a quarter in the bed. I was like, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, a vibrating bed." I'm like, "Oh my God, yeah." The 60s in some dodgy hotel where you put quarters in beds to make them shake.
So
He goes, "There was eight people sitting on the bed." And he goes, "We're on a spaceship." And I went, "Okay."
strapping.
Has that cheered you up at all, Zara?
I loved this story so much, especially like his kind of final recut, like retelling of that, where he was like, it was weird. It was like a Federico Fellini thing. It was so strange that I really did believe that everybody was dead and I was the only one that survived it.
Oh, well, like, this is like, yeah, his worst drug experience then, yeah, in Detroit on Crystal THC.
So
where he wakes up and there's just like, I guess, bodies everywhere and we're just going back downhill. Yeah. But yeah.
He was in, wasn't Alice Cooper a member of the Hollywood Vampires drinking club?
Yeah.
Yeah, he yeah. was, wasn't he?
Which was like Hollywood Vampires,
Harry
Johnny
Nelson.
Depp. No, oh, sorry, okay.
The original iteration.
Okay, was he not like the frontman for that weird Hollywood Vampires, Johnny Depp slash...
There is a band called the Hollywood Vampires, and I think they took the name from the group.
That makes sense. And it sounds like a cooler group, the original group. So it was Harry Nilsson, just other people
John
on a lost
Lennon,
weekend. Right.
Alice Cooper, and I think maybe Ringo perhaps went on a few of them. It's like, well, like,
you're just throwing that in. You don't know.
I think
that.
He was.
It feels like Ringo would have vibed with that. Oh, we're getting the members here from Adam. I'm trying to read. Okay. Oh, Keith Moon.
Ringo
Starr, you're
right.
Correct. I apologize. Mickey Dolenz as well. Oh. What a crew.
But yeah, they used to go out for like 4 nights at a time, just like drinking. Sounded
oh
great
God.
Crack.
Yeah. The madness continues, however, in the music industry. Ja Rule, he's made an announcement. He's still harping on the Fyre Festival thing. This is, I'm sad to say, NFT Corner, the continuation. I had to include this one.
I know, you're
he's
obsessed. Selling, you're obsessed, Craig.
He's selling the cheese sandwich tweet about the Fyre Festival. Wasn't even his tweet, but he's collaborating with the guy who sent the tweet, so it's all grand. To bring people up to speed, Fyre Festival 2017 event, Ja Rule teamed up with Billy McFarland to create the world's greatest festival in the Bahamas. Tickets were like everywhere between like $4,000 to like $12,000, and didn't happen. The whole thing was a total wash and the whole thing was a total scam. Mm-hmm. And kind of symbolic of this was Trevor De Haas, his image of a meager snack that they got, which was him just saying like, you know, this is the dinner that Fyre Festival promised us, was catered by Steven Starr. It's literally bread, cheese and salad with dressing, and it was just this like styrofoam container you'd get at any dodgy like down the country Irish festival.
Yeah.
And yeah, so
when
they're selling it.
When I read on, yeah. this story initially, I was really tired going through it, and I got past the first sentence and I completely skipped the word tweet. So I read, Ja Rule has announced that he is selling the infamous cheese sandwich from the ill-fated Fyre Festival. And I wrote, like, I was so perturbed. I like immediately shot up, sat up in my bed, and I just wrote beside it, what the fuck does that look like now?
Oh my God. So I think I would prefer that than like something totally non-fungible.
Yeah.
It's described as a meme, a cultural touchstone, a cheese sandwich. There's a whole kind of statement about the sale. From an inauspicious dinner, photographer Trevor De Haas captured the most iconic image from 2017's most famous debacle, the Fyre Festival. Two limp white slices on wheat
detail.
Bread lay
like the lifeless body of Icarus.
Of Icarus. Bemoaning the hubris of man.
Oh, God. Oh, a moment.
I want to buy the NFT of this press release.
Oh, same. A moment
a timeless
for that description.
Image, yeah, a timeless image of inestimable cultural import sold now as a singular NFT. The current estimated price is $80,000. All proceeds are going towards medical expenses for De Haas's daily dialysis and kidney transplant. So the guy's in a bad way. He needs to raise funds. It's fair enough. It seems like Ja Rule's maybe doing a good thing here, possibly. But
he has already...
Am I giving him too much credit?
Yeah. He's already acquired $122,000 from some... He previously sold his Fyre Festival logo oil painting in NFT form for that amount. So could he not just use that money and give it to De Haas? Like,
Ja Rule moves in mysterious ways, okay? Yeah. He's a true artist and we shouldn't question him.
Seems like a lot of de hassle for some NFT.
Hey, de hassle. Fantastic. It's a pity we still don't do like episode titles because that would be a shoo-in. Yeah, I was looking at that oil painting that he sold, right? And he said, like, the reason he sold it wasn't the money. He just wanted that energy out. I think there was, like, bad energy to it or something. But he sold it as an NFT. So surely it's, like, the digital form. He still has the painting. And surely the bad energy remains, no?
Yeah. I'm still...
It's all getting too metaphysical for me.
I
don't know.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around NFT. It's taken me a while to fully understand it. It took me a while to understand Bitcoin and I finally got there. So I'm predicting that I'll know the sus on NFT by episode 300 of Now Encore, perhaps.
Okay, we might have to get you back on. Oh, we'll do an NFT special and Dave will announce that he is quitting the show. All right. Okay. If you've got bad energy you need to get out of your life, we might just have the podcast for you. It's called The Happy Broadcast. First episode is out now. Take a listen to this.
Tired of tuning into negative news? Well, get your week off to the right start with The Happy Broadcast. Let's help you focus on the positive things happening in our world. Each episode will feature positive news, some mental health tips, and we'll hear from our Happy Broadcast community about what makes them happy. The podcast is hosted by me, Amy O'Dwyer, in collaboration with Mauro Gatti and his popular social channel, The Happy Broadcast. Episodes are out every Monday and you can listen and subscribe wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Let's help spread some positivity.
Okay, and you heard a lovely trailer for a lovely podcast there and I listened to maybe a dozen clips of Drowned in the Sun. Again, a song that will never leave my psyche now. We had some
technical difficulties
that required testing, which Adam dutifully carried out as I lost my mind. Let's see, can we wash it all away with some actually, you know, quite good music? We'll find out if it's good. It's album time. We turn our attention to the debut album from London four-piece Dry Cleaning. No Glas Vegas for us. They were initially penciled in, but we didn't go for it. So we'll have to wait for round two of Zara versus James Allen.
Thank God you saved me from that celebrity death match. There.
Yeah, one of my picks for landfill indie songs that were actually good, but... Yeah. No, we're not going to do that album. Instead, we're going to turn to a very of-the-moment proposition. Even if the music did kind of remind me of my landfill heyday, i.e. my college years at times, it's getting like fevered notices, critical acclaim. The only opinion I want to hear is that of Zara Hederman's, but before that, let's hear a little sample of it.
You keep it. Weak arms can't open the door, can't feel cancel. It'll be okay, I just need to be weird and hide for a bit and eat an old sandwich from my bag. I've come here to make a ceramic shoe and I've come to smash what you made. I've come to learn how to mingle, I've come to learn how to dance.
And yeah, that's Scratch Hard Lanyard taken from New Long Leg. And Zara, before I turn to you, I guess bring new listeners up to speed a little bit. So who are these people, to quote Jerry Seinfeld? Well, they're a post-punk proposition from South London, only together about 3 years. They were kind of players themselves. They were together a little longer. All kind of old friends. I think 30-somethings that were just in kind of like hardcore punk bands that never really broke through over the course of their 20s. They brought Florence Shaw on board in 2017 and she was just kind of getting on with her life as a uni lecturer, photo researcher, and over a pint with the guitarist Tom Dowse, he played some kind of demos on his phone of them just working together. She liked it. He thought her like kind of spoken word musings over the top would be perfect. And there's a weird serendipity. It kind of works. It's been going well for them. And happily, she'd like a stack of collected phrases, like lists of ad copy, social media comments. So kind of delving beyond her own notebooks to go kind of below the lines online. And I think she was going to use it for like in a visual medium, but instead she has this kind of cut and paste style around her own narrative she brings to these songs. So it's made for some kind of jagged, witty works already. There's been two EPs. This is them paired with producer John Parrish. It's their 4AD debut. And Zara, we turn to you. How have you got on with New Long Leg over the course of the week?
Yeah, I absolutely loved this album. When you and Ishi kind of said that it was Glass Vegas and then kind of proposed dry cleaning, immediately I wanted to do the dry cleaning one because it was one that it was an album and a band that I had just seen so much hype and press about in the kind of leading up, say, like month of the release of the album. And usually in a lot of times, that kind of hype really puts me off listening to an album, even if it is getting like like critically acclaimed and whatnot and favorable reviews from people that I really admire. I do think that sometimes the hype can compromise the actual integrity of what is then presented to you, and it can also sure. just be quite hyperbolic, and what you get is shit. But I thought that with this, it's such an amazing, spontaneous album. Florence Shaw's cadence there, I mean, from that snippet that we just heard, I think even though it can be quite monotone, and when you just get that initial introduction to it, you could be kind of worried that, you know, this is just a very one-note album, that like a lot of her descriptions and her lyrics get lost because of that monotony or whatever. But what I was so impressed with throughout this album is just how she tempers her cadence and uses it to add in hooks and melody really subtly without you kind of realizing that she's done that until like maybe like the second or third listen. There was times where she reminded me of, say, like Nico. I know a lot of places have been kind of comparing her to maybe like John Cooper Clark or Patti Smith. And kind of going back to what you were saying about her visual medium with the kind of the poetry that she had, I think that this is such a vivid album. Like, she's so descriptive. Her lyrics are so specific, from, you know, like the porcelain shoe and going to the knitting circle, or like talking about sausages and all this kind of stuff. So she's so, one of the great things that I liked about her lyricism is just how colloquial her language is, because I think that that just, the familiarity makes it so easy to become stuck in your head, which I loved. Just the musicianship on this album as well, I think, is fantastic. I love how it's really indebted to the 80s, to the kind of post, to like, you know, say a Joy Division, Wire magazine and whatnot, but it yeah. still retains quite a lot of freshness. And actually it really reminded me of Shame, the band who brought out their second album in January. And there was weird moments, actually, Craig, that I was kind of excited to ask you about. There was times where I really got a bang of the Strokes off them. Like, even just okay. the intro of the album, what is it, Scratch Card Lanyard, like that drum machine.
That kind of bassline. Like a linear. Yeah,
and then later on, there's some like early kind of Strokes chords and riffs. And I was like, oh, that's like kind of nice and unexpected as well. So did it work for you? What were you thinking when you were listening to this?
It's funny because definitely like they feel like a band that have a lot of my own touchstones. So yeah, like we did One and Done albums recently, and one of my like prime picks was a 2001 record, which is Life Without Buildings, Any Other City, which were a Glaswegian kind of indie outfit, but also doing that kind of quite singular kind of sung spoken word thing. I was like enamored with that in my like late teens, like tail end of the noughties, when it was already kind of like a lost classic, or like people on, you know, hipster blogs or like Drowned in Sound forums would be like, this is a sacred text and it's great. I was kind of wondering if that was the case for Florence Shaw, and yeah, wondering if the guys listened to all the stuff I did, which would include of course the Strokes. So yeah, comparing it to Life Without Buildings, it certainly feels like, if not like a kind of long-awaited comeback from them, they're broken up, but kind of like the 2020s reboot, which was interesting. Like, even moving through tracks like Strong Feelings, it was all just like, the week was soaked in like college afternoons skipping lectures and like Adam and Joe podcasts and or actually probably radio shows. Was it a podcast? It was probably like the first podcast.
Yeah.
Or like watching Peep Show. Like it feels like it could be soundtracking the internal monologues on Peep Show at times. And kind of very early millennial or even like Gen X humor. Like I was right there agreeing with her kind of wry takes on like the Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
And it's kind of self-effacing and sarcastic and it's kind of like slightly obfuscated as well. Like it didn't feel like that Gen Z thing where it's all about frank honesty and confessionals and it's all out front like a Arlo Parks or Phoebe Bridgers. There's this kind of weaponized sneer here that I certainly found comforting, which is great. But it's totally like an up-to-date context for sure because, you know, like I think their debut single was The Magic of Meghan. So Meghan Markle doesn't get more up-to-date than that. And like the social media collage thing is being done before, but I don't think really with the kind of verve and the commitments you see here. And she just does it so, she's such a dab hand at it. It works so well. And it's right, I guess, that we talk about voice and lyrics first. Like I bought into her empathy through the various kind of narratives and storytellers she uses. Like that track we just heard, it's kind of like a young mother getting out of the house and like dipping into some like excruciating like adult socializing activities or something like that.
Yeah.
Felt like this new fold of rock music where it's just kind of compendiums of like unsent tweets or something.
Yeah. It's just so very everyday, which is I think that's what I really loved about it is that like it really brought me, I was immediately in her world like from the get-go. And like what I loved as well is that like it's kind of like what you were saying with the Gen Z kind of vernacular. It's like it's kind of pre-midlife crisis, but like but like there's so much malaise to it, but her humor is so acerbic, it's so funny. But even just like with the characters as well, there's like I think one that's just broken up with someone and they're possibly like moving out of their house and it's just like, oh well, what are you gonna do with all the stuff in your cupboards? Like, are you gonna take your mayonnaise and what about the grill? You have to clean that. And I recently just moved out of somewhere and I just like completely had like understood and related to those like thoughts of like that final press in the kitchen that was just waiting to be cleared out. And I was like, oh god, I relate so hard to this person in this song.
Amazing.
But yeah, the Antiques Roadshow lyric is so funny. And then there's also In Strong Feelings, which at times in just the pacing of her delivery, she reminded me so much of Jarvis Cocker, just in like her meter and also
yes,
the way she tackled the subject matter as well. But there's like a lyric in that song where it's like, I spent £17 on mushrooms for you because I'm silly. And it's just like, it's like so true. You can also just imagine the really bougie like food place that's probably called Vegetable and Bean, like with that she bought those mushrooms from. So yeah, there was just something so humble about this album, but that was
I think that's why it kind of works. Finish your thought there, but I was gonna say like I was worried would it grate over the course of an album. And I guess if people haven't listened to it, they might think, okay, I like that song, but it's this spoken word thing and it could veer into the kooky or get a bit too knowing. But actually I think somehow as an album it works even better for me. I don't know how they're going to do a second record. I guess that's not their problem at the moment. But there's a real purpose to it as a whole.
I really really loved it, and the more I listened to it, like I got really excited to go back to it, which generally by say like 8th, 9th listen I'm kind of about to give up. But no, with this I loved it. I loved her vocals. I loved how she implemented certain articulations as well. I just thought the way she used her voice was so unexpectedly varied just because of the specific tone that she had and the breadth of the arrangements. They're really subtle, and the more you listen to it, the more you realize how big they are in their kind of contained nature too, which I just thought was really impressive. So yeah, I'm definitely very very excited for more from them.
I think John Parrish on production can take some credit as well, because like he's worked with PJ Harvey at likes of Let England Shake. The band say they just instantly hit it off with him and he got them, like he's, you know, the producer just gets them. But it feels like he just kind of molded them quite well. He didn't like you know, brush them up too much or change what they were doing. He just kind of got what this band was about. And as for the band, like, itself, like, the musicians, I mean, they're not, like, probably generational talents or something. They're not immediately amazing, but they can't be written off as kind of, like, you know, competent indie bods. Like, I think the rhythm section do bring kind of variety. They're quite kind of spry, considering it's a throwback sound.
Yeah.
I did think Tom Dowse was pretty effective on guitar. Like, there's some vague reference points. Like, at times I was thinking of, like, he reminded me how much Johnny Marr loves the Stooges. Like, it just felt like that kind of lineage was there. The Art Your End, kind of, there's flashes of, like, Sonic Youth School. And I think the guitar at times brings, like, a lot of emotion that maybe isn't there in her, like, you know, journey down Deadpan Alley. But it kind of works quite well. And considering, like, there's a lot of reference points to the sound, it didn't feel like they were recycling kind of riffs that we've heard over decades. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't moments where I was like, well, that's that song and that's that song, which was refreshing for sure.
Yeah, another thing that kind of struck me today when I was listening to it was it reminded me of how excited I would get when I was 15 and, like, devout to Enemy and Q magazine. And it just, like, it made me think of, say, the bands who formed in, say, 2017, 2018, and who are now coming out with either a debut album or a second album, say, in the case of Shame. So, like, be it, like, Dry Cleaning or even, like, Black Country, New Road, who I don't really have a huge amount of time for at the moment. I'm still trying to delve into them, or, like, Squid or Goat Girl or whatever. Dry Cleaning just really reminded me how they're a part of a wave of bands. And I know they're all British bands that I've mentioned at the moment, but it was kind of similar with the growing up with Enemy, Q magazine, where that was kind of where you were getting your bands from the UK. And it also just made me think of how, like, they are maybe, like, the say the Cribs of BBC Six music now, if that makes any sense.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So in that way, it got me excited about that kind of driving culture of music and bands that are in a kind of loose community together. So yeah, anything that gets me less snarky about new music, because for the most part it can be quite frustrating, but yeah, I liked it.
If you had to put a score on this, what would you give it?
I think I'd give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I think, like, it steers kind of admirably clear of, like, kitsch and the twee, which it could do. It's accessible. I think it's quite an easy recommend. And yeah, you mentioned Black Country New Roads, like, they can get a bit, like, attention grabbing and in their, like, esoteric way. But this feels like they're just kind of sidling up to you in a bookshop or something and starting a conversation.
Yeah.
And yeah, your point earlier was really good about how they captured the everyday. Like, you know, rock used to be high drama and, like, escapism and grand gestures that you would then bring into your kind of small daily battles. And here it's more like a kind of crowdsourced, like, retelling of, like, just the modern minutiae of our, like, daily lives. You can kind of find some freedom and relief in that. And what I'm saying, it's like a socialist text.
Indeed.
And if the revolution comes, I'm going to have to give it an 8 out of 10, so I avoid the guillotine.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's Dry Cleaning's new long leg. Strong recommend from both of us, so check it out. And we will move on to our top five, which is of course inspired by Dry Cleaning. We're going spoken word. It's Talking in Songs. And Zara, when you got the brief and we discussed it on WhatsApp, what were you thinking? Where did you go with it? Were you excited for it? Were you utterly confused and wondering, why is Craig contacting me on a Monday to make me do a show?
Well, my phone had 1% battery as well, so I didn't have too much time to ask you too many questions about it. I almost exploded with excitement when you said, let's do spoken word, because without really realizing it until I thought about this top five, there are so many songs that are within my kind of canon of top songs of all time that have spoken word in it. So I had, I'd say at least four of these that came immediately to me. So yeah, no, absolutely so much fun to do. Very tricky to whittle it down, I have to say. How did you feel about this one, Craig? Were you excited?
Yeah, I thought like there was a few easy selections, but then the more I thought about it, the more difficult it got. I woke up this morning with a particular song in my head, which I nearly like shouted out loud. I was like, I forgot to put this in the list. I didn't have time to do a clip, and like Adam had the clip, so it's just gone. It's like lost, like tears and rain. Here is one track as an example of what we're talking about. It's from our Songs of the Year, which Zara joined us for. And yeah, it's a track from last year. Let's have a listen to Annie doing a spoken word bit. Really dug that last year. That's kind of very throwbacky. Like it reminded me of some of the 50s and 60s attempts at it, where it's like just kind of ratchet up the melodrama and like get cinematic with it.
Yeah.
Okay, Adam has instructed me to go first, otherwise I would be like Zara full steam ahead, but all right, we'll go for my number five, and this is answering the question of how you follow up one of the most revered albums of the century.
Hello, ma'am. Can I be of any assistance? Seems to me that you have lost something. I would like to help you find it. She replied, oh yes, you have lost something. You've lost your life.
Is it wickedness?
Lamar stated his views on police brutality with that line in the song, quote, and we hate the popo, want to kill us in the street, faux show.
Ah, please. Ugh. I don't like it.
Craig, yeah, you've Kendrick only Lamar. Gone and done it.
Zara, you like that one, yeah? It's a good start, isn't it? It's it kind of came to me slightly late because it is a recent-ish as well. So I was like, I caught it at the right time. I didn't wake up screaming, luckily, on this track. It's Kendrick Lamar, it's Blood, taken from Damn. And this is a bit of a twofer because you have that initial kind of Kendrick delivery of this monologue. It's kind of like a parable, a fable almost, where he's like parking the rap for some spoken word, like backed by some Morricone style kind of weepy Western strings and stuff. But then also you have the use of an audio clip, infamously, which is Fox News. I think it's one of the greatest like fuck yous in music of late. Like it's a political statement just by playing it. Like he goes all in then on DNA, but just having that mirror up to them without comment is powerful enough. It's kind of unexpectedly hilarious, punctures the kind of tension just with their sheer kind of buffoonery. I don't like it has really entered my lexicon. I say that quite a bit, which is the hallmark of a great drop. And it's, of course, Fox News criticizing Kendrick's performance of All Right, a very positive song at the BET Awards. And yeah, you've got the likes of Geraldo also just after that being like, listen, this is why I say hip hop has done more damage to young African-Americans than racism in recent years. Eric Bowling, you hear there, Kimberly Guilfoyle, what the hell? But what an intro, Zara, yeah?
Oh, Craig, as soon as you press play on that, my whole top five, it's just so insignificant now.
Oh, don't say that. Keep listening.
No, that is the strongest. That's the strongest five I've ever heard in my life. I have went back and I was listening to Damn, I think it was about 2 months ago. I got really, really into it again. And there was a time where I couldn't leave the house when I was on my way to work and not just stick it on. It's such a propulsive and driving album from start to finish. Mm. And then I set myself a little project of listening to Damn and then going to that podcast, Dissect, is it?
Yeah.
Where the guy Yeah, where he dissects the meanings of an album track by track and almost kind of line by line. And I only got about 3 or 4 episodes into his look into Dam, and I just found it so fascinating, the level of detail that he went into. But and even as you were saying there, like the Morricone-esque like strings, and to make it sound like a Western, like when I heard that kind of analogy initially, it was something that I completely just glossed over, and then it just made the whole song all the more impactful and just amazing in the kind of roguish nature that Lamar took in, like,
yeah,
basically telling Fox News to go fuck themselves. Like, yeah, no, that is absolutely incredible. I'm actually really annoyed at myself now. I'm so annoyed.
I'm setting myself up for a fail with the rest of the list, I think. Let's get into yours. What is your number 5 there?
Okay, so my number 5 is one of my favorite voices in music of all time. And it just so happens that he released an album that was 50% spoken word in 1963. So hit it, Adam.
The time Zickafoos was 20, he had a face on him. It looked like somebody'd run 4 wagons together. I guess Winfield Bloodsaw, he's the fella that runs the feed store in trouble, said it about as good as anybody when he said that if we had one of those Mr. America contests in trouble, and Emory Zickafoos Brown was the only one to enter, the best he could possibly hope for was 4th place. Nobody loves me in this town.
There we go.
Yeah, so that was, of course, the unmistakable endless baritone of Lee Hazlewood with Ugly Brown, from his, it's considered his debut album, called Trouble is a Lonesome Town. It's a sort of concept album as well that details different characters and life in a sort of metaphorical but also kind of real town called Trouble. It's one of my favourite albums just to stick on and listen to, because as I said, it's half spoken word, half music, and it is that very much kind of saccharine cowboy style. That song in particular, Ugly Brown, it was so difficult to choose one song from this album, because the stories throughout are just, they're so funny, and his way of retelling them is just hilarious. But I thought that the poor story of Emory Zickafoos Brown deserved to be reimagined as a legend, as a top 5 at a best of something.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaker. I do not know this whatsoever. I'm ashamed to say Lee Hazlewood, I'm of course aware of and some of his bigger works, but like I kind of stopped at Nancy and Lee, which is just like total beginners LP. It's like the one essential you have to check out. So like unmistakable though, like I knew the voice and I was like, why have I never heard this? Are you a massive fan? Like, should we all be diving into the entire back catalog? Like,
he's absolutely incredible. So I first heard of Lee Hazlewood. My brother used to make, he still does make them, but makes them as playlists now. He would make like mixed CDs. And the first time I heard Lee Hazlewood was when I was 16 on one of those compilations, and it was of a song from that album called Look at That Woman, which when you listen to it now doesn't really age too well. But that's how I got into it, and then got into the Nancy and Lee album. And then there's also a second Nancy and Lee album from 1972 that's lesser kind of known and talked about, but it's like equally brilliant. His career is absolutely fascinating. If you don't know anything about him at all, just like a kind of brief overview is like he initially studied to be a doctor and then got drafted into the Korean War. And when he left, or when he got home, he worked as a DJ for like a local radio station in Phoenix. And while he was working there as a DJ, he was also writing songs, because he kind of then got to figure out the mold and what you needed to write a hit song.
Right.
So he kind of became proficient in songwriting that way. And then Frank Sinatra came to him and was just like, here, I really want you to write something for my daughter because I want her to be a star, basically. And that's when, like, Those Boots Are Made for Walking came about. And she described Lee Hazlewood as somewhere between part Henry Higgins, part Sigmund Freud.
Terrifying.
Just such as the kind of closeness. Yeah, really scary. But Dean Martin had a similar thing where he also came to him and wanted him to write music for his daughter, Deanna. I don't think to the same kind of success. But yeah, no, he's just, I think he's an amazing songwriter. As I said, I would often stick this album in particular on just to listen to it because the stories are just so rogue. They're really country drenched ballads, and they're just great. They're great crack, and his voice is undeniable.
Nice. I'm going to check it out. I will report back. My next one is probably most recognizable to people with an actual melody now, which is disappointing to me slightly, when it was covered by the Arctic Monkeys. Completely unnecessary, I think. Here it is. He's been mentioned already. Okay, that was John Cooper Clarke, "Would I Want to Be Yours?" And he kind of maybe represents a whole strand of front person here, vocalist, musical poet, maybe. Spoiler alert, like, Patti Smith just split my vote totally, which always happens, and Dave doesn't quite understand what that means, but, like, it could have been Piss Factory, or it could have been, like, her doing, like, a Smells Like Teen Spirit cover and just going off into wild apocalyptic verse. I picked John Cooper Clarke because this is really the only song of his that I really listen to and really like. He's a good poet from Salford, and people love him, and he's an old punk and stuff, and yeah, he's clearly accomplished, but this really struck a chord with me kind of years ago. I think it's great. It clearly did with Alex Turner as well. They recorded their own version on the album AM. It was on at the end, and that version doesn't really work for me whatsoever. Like, clearly, I think they're mates with John Cooper Clarke, and it clearly meant, like, a paycheck for him, and I'm sure he was absolutely delighted, so good that they did it. But, like, Alex Turner adds this Lounge Lizard melody to it, like, with his kind of, you know, baritone thing, and it feels kind of like a sleazy come-on, which is definitely not here. Like, here, it's just so simple, kind of so naive and sweet, and I love the kind of meager means he uses to kind of express his love, but there's also kind of enormous longing in it as well. And I think actually the backing to it is musically kind of brilliant. Like, there's an excellent canvas for him just to kind of do his very kind of unmistakable spoken word thing over it. It was Martin Hannett, the producer, who kind of put that all together on the album Zip Style Method. I think it was 82. It's one of the last kind of things Martin Hannett did. He's, like, famous for producing Joy Division magazine, a kind of troubled character himself, but just really distinctive, and, like, you know, those sparse kind of, like, cavernous sounds which you can hear here. And I think that takes it away from being something that might sound a little like slam poetry with a different kind of dressing up. Just works really well.
Yeah, I actually exactly the same as you with Lee Hazlewood. John Cooper Clarke is not someone that I've listened to really at all, so I have not heard that song before, so thank you, Craig, that
check it out.
That was a nice introduction.
You're welcome. And now you can return the favor with your number four.
Okay, so Craig, pop quiz time.
Oh, Jesus.
Do you know
oh, with Dave being off, like, I could avoid the constant
pressure. No, I have to bring the quiz.
All right, let's do it.
In Dave's honor, you have to bring the quiz. Okay. Can you think of an artist who has released over 60 albums from the 1960s and then well into posthumous period of their kind of existence.
Yeah.
And they only managed to have one top 40 single.
Oh, I was going Elvis all the way until that last detail. One top 40 single. Oh.
Out of 60 albums. Plus.
Hold on. Is it William Shatner?
No.
No!
It is.
Who is it? Go on.
Adam, put the boy out of his misery.
Encino's like so bitchin'. There's like the Galleria. I'm like all these like really great shoe stores. I like love going into like clothing stores and stuff. I like buy the neatest mini skirts and stuff. It's like so bitchin' because like everybody's like super, super nice. It's like so bitchin'. Like,
yeah, so that was Moon Zappa collaborating with her dad, Frank Zappa. So if you ever actually have a father-daughter top five, that could be a shoo-in for number one. That was Valley Girl from Frank Zappa's Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch 1982 album. The whole kind of concept and origins of this song, I thought we're kind of sweet but also slightly sad in that like Zappa and his band had the guitar riff for about a year from just like jamming during a sound check, but they had nowhere to put it really. And also Moon Zappa, who was 14 at the time when she recorded that, she really wanted to work with her dad I guess as a way to spend time with him, right. Which is kind of sad to think that, like, you know, your own daughter has to try and like get you in the studio to have some quality time with them. But when you're someone like Frank Zappa, just absolutely, you know, whipping the albums out, that is one way that you'll get to do that. So as you hear there, like she's whipping through, like, you know, going down to the valley and she's getting her toes done. She's getting some bitching clothes and it's all like really funny. That all came about when Moon would come home from one of the details, actually, when I was researching this that I just found gas was they were like, oh, when she would come home from bar mitzvahs, specifically bar mitzvahs, she would recreate conversations that she was hearing her peers have, and she would improv them to like her dad and his mates, and they were like, that's kind of gas. So there was one night at about 3 a.m, and Frank Zappa just went into her bedroom, woke her up, and took her down to the studio and was like, okay, that Valley Girl accent that you do, I want you to do a whole song of it and just improvise. And yeah, it became Frank Zappa's sole top 40 song.
Amazing.
It's absolutely hilarious, but I think he was quite like ticked off about it because I think at the time he didn't want to be just pegged as like a novelty artist. Obviously he had Don't Eat the Yellow Snow as well. Valley Girl kind of didn't really, you know, do him any favours in that front. But he was always very forthcoming on how much he hated the San Fernando Valley. He thought it was really depressing. He said it represents a number of very evil things. But one of the things that I found really bizarre about this song and things to kind of be born from it was that he hired a guy to get like merchandising deals for him based on the song and the lyrics and the character that Moon plays in it. So he licensed a clothing and cosmetic line and dolls using the Valley Girl imprint, and he had an official Valley Girl colouring book. Craig, could you imagine how incredible that colouring book would be? Like,
oh my God, yeah. It's got to be on eBay. Like,
It has to be. And like for worth mega or books. Like,
imagine doing that, but also being ticked off that it becomes a hit song. Like, that's a lot of effort, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, he didn't perform it live. He rarely talked about it in interviews as well. But he also was saying that he wanted to work on a screenplay that was based on the song. But that got like swiped out of his hands. And a film was actually made called Valley Girl. But Zappa had nothing to do with it. And it starred a young and up and coming Nicolas Cage.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
No, I'm going to watch it this weekend for sure. But there was one really funny anecdote as well about it. So shortly after it came out in 1982, there was a Philadelphia radio DJ called Terry Motormouth Young, who played the song 10 times consecutively with no break in between. And the station manager burst into the room and just fired him basically on the spot. So
well deserved. Not really into Frank Zappa. I do love Watermelon and Easter Hay. I got into that like in a big way recently. And I was like thinking, will I get into Frank Zappa now? So I nearly would have got that trivia right if I had decided to. But I thought, listen, Steely Dan and like then trying to maybe get into the Grateful Dead. I can't go full Frank Zappa as well in the same fucking 2 years. Do you know what I mean?
It is a bit boomer like.
Yeah, it really is. So for another time, that'll be my midlife crisis. Okay, speaking of midlife crisis, let's get funky. It's about time I got funky. Sorry, here's my number three.
You may ask yourself, what is that beautiful house? You may ask yourself, where does that highway go to? And you may ask yourself, am I right? Am I wrong? And you may say to yourself, my God, what have I done? Letting the days go by, let
the water hold me down. Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime. And yeah, like 80s icons doing like sermon style, spoken word, vamping. Let's Go Crazy could have been there. I don't think I can have Prince on every list. I went for another kind of huge cultural moment, and it's like a square David Byrne in a suit. Yeah. Empathizing with your like existential crisis just before, I think it was 1980, 1981, just before the dawning of Reagan's America, which is great. It's obviously off Remain in Light, and Byrne was like struggling with writer's block, but he came up some great lines. And I was just reading a bit about how he came up with this, and he like disagreed with people saying, oh, this was quite prescient, you know, like the excesses of the 80s and all that kind of stuff. And he said it's like the lyrics and the spoken word here is just about how we're actually largely like unconscious, and we're operating like we're half awake and on autopilot, and then sometimes we just realize like we have a house and a family and a job and haven't really stopped to ask how did I get here. Which really chimed with me this week as I kind of go, like, how did I end up in the bathroom looking for my phone as lockdown becomes a thing where, like, my short-term memory doesn't function anymore? So, like, this really spoke to me.
Wait, why was your phone in the bathroom in the first place, Craig?
It wasn't. That's the whole point. I was like, how did I end up in the bathroom? Sorry. It was in my coat pocket downstairs. Like, it's a whole to-do. It's Talking Heads. Oh, I kind of just picked this because I saw you finished Remain in Love, the Chris Franz book, and I wanted to ask you about it. How was it? Is it worth reading? Because I haven't got to it yet. And he seems like a bit of a bitter dude. Doesn't like David Byrne all that much.
Hates him.
Okay.
He really hates him. So I finished it over the weekend. And to say that it was a chore to read is not an understatement. He's just extremely bitter. He's also the horniest toad I've ever come across in my life. Like, he literally cannot mention a woman without commenting on how hot he thought she was, whether or not she was like someone that he wanted to fuck or whatever, or like if it's Tina, he's always like, oh,
who
Tina,
he's been with Tina Weymouth since they were like in college together, right? And still a very happy
couple. They've been married for like 42 years, but the main portion of the book as well, it's really disappointing. Like, he just talks about, say, like his RISD days. He really kind of has rose tinted kind of glasses on those days in his life. And then the Talking Head stuff is basically just their tour around Europe and the UK with the Ramones. Like, it's extremely Ramone heavy. I was really then interested and looking forward to get into, say, like the Stop Making Sense kind of portion of the book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Craig, 3 pages and that's it.
What?
Never mentioned again. 3 pages, yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. So it's kind of like the Morrissey book where it's just like you get a bit of the Smiths and then it's like court cases for about, 100 pages.
You really, Yeah, you really get the bare minimum, and it's also just really badly written. He's not a very good writer at all. But like, it was a good read in that, like, just to see like what a bitter person he is. Like, that was kind of a bit of crack every now and again, but it was very eye roll inducing.
Okay, so not worth it. Okay, I'm glad I asked. Saved me some time. Do you want to go for your next selection?
Yeah. Okay. So Craig, how do you call your lover boy?
Come here, lover boy.
You wouldn't do it, perhaps, like how Mickey and Sylvia would do.
Yes, Mickey.
How do you call your lover boy?
Come here, lover boy.
And if he doesn't answer?
Oh, lover boy.
And if he still doesn't answer?
I simply say, baby. Oh, baby. My sweet baby. You're the one.
Oh my God, I am so cursed introducing my top five songs. It's unbelievable. That, of course, was Mickey and Sylvia, Love is Strange. Listeners will probably know it best from the iconic scene in Dirty Dancing when Jennifer Grey and Patrick Swayze are crawling, thrusting on the floor towards each other and miming it together. Craig, do you know much about Mickey and Sylvia as an act?
Funny you should mention that. Adam, can you play my number two?
Sylvia.
Yes, Mickey.
How you call your lover boy?
Come here, lover boy.
And if he doesn't answer?
Oh, lover boy.
And if he still doesn't answer?
I simply say,
so tell us, Sarah, it's my number two as well. I've been doing a bit of reading. I did not know that much, but this is tremendous. A great shout from both of us. And give us some background.
Well, first off, high five, hon. That's unreal. Right? And especially how it lined up. And Adam, excellent work there as well. You little legend. So I really liked this song for a long time, but actually when I started to research the song, I realized that I knew nothing about the figures of Mickey and Sylvia. So they started recording together in 1954. Mickey Baker was inspired by the success of husband and wife musical duo Les Paul and Mary Ford. And he then wanted to form a kind of similar duo. And he did so with one of his pupils, because he was a music instructor. So Sylvia Robinson then became his Mary Ford, if you will. They were on various labels. They had like great success with them. But then, and I was actually really impressed with this, they had the kind of foresight to establish their own label, Willow Records. And then they were sharing a bill with Bo Diddley in Washington, and they heard that Bo Diddley playing Love is Strange, and then with his blessing they recorded their own version. But then there was also some kind of scandooch in that like Sylvia claims that she and Mickey wrote the lyrics, but it was actually Bo who wrote the lyrics but then did it under his then wife's name, Ethel Smith, which I thought was an interesting move. Yeah, obviously in a tremendous song, and I think my favourite part about the story of Mickey and Sylvia is that Sylvia started Sugar Hill Records and put together the Sugar Hill Gang, and then therefore Amazing. Gave us Rapper's Delight.
What a pair. Yeah, I love this. It's in loads of stuff. Obviously Dirty Dancing, I think it's in Casino. I always think of an early episode of The Wire where McNulty is like finishing a noggin or maybe a shoulder in his cop car, and like I think he spots a crime in the distance and like falls on his arse in the rain, and this is just playing like Sylvia, like so good. It's tremendous. It's kind of like, it could be like hokey kind of excellence, but I love their delivery. It's so great. It feels like one of those like early like screwball rom-coms where it's like, you know, My Girl Tuesday or whatnot, His Girl Friday or one of those Cary Grant things, but like in 30 seconds, just that exchange, and then like the nonchalance of them being like, you know, back into the sick licks that we're laying down. It's so cool. I just love it so much. I'm really glad you picked it, and it's great. And they re-recorded apparently in the 60s, and it featured Bernard Pretty Purdy on drums, which was his first paid session gig, and that's just a tidbit for the Steely Dan fans out there.
Oh my god,
tremendous drummer. All right, do you want to do your number two, seeing as we've just done mine? Cool.
Okay, so my silver medal this week is a song that I first heard when I was 15, and almost half my lifetime after that, because I'm nearly 30, it still has the same kind of impact. So hit it, Adam.
Ear of my skull, wet, damp, windows dripping and misted with coal, walls of gray, nothing good on the radio, not a thought in my head. Slow it down, incredibly slow, frame by frame. The 2 minutes that take 10 years.
Yeah, so that was The Cribs, and with a guest vocal appearance from Lee Ronaldo of Sonic Youth. That was just, I think when you said to me initially about doing spoken word, this song was the first one that came into my mind. Yeah, as I said, I remember so vividly when this came out when I was 15. Such a formative time in, you know, finding my musical tastes. And this album, Men's Needs, Women's Needs, whatever, it just left such an impression on me. I really loved how they were kind of the outliers of that scene as well. I always found this song in particular, which one thing that really annoys me, I actually went back to listening to that album last night. I hadn't done it in a long time. It really annoys me that Be Safe is not the closing track. I think that would just would've be such really a well. Marvellous. Yeah, it would have been so good. I know you're a fan of this song, Ezra. Well, I know you're a fan of The Cribs.
This was in my shortlist for sure. Yeah, it didn't quite make it.
I was kind of worried that this would have the crossover. I would never have expected it to come
Mickey and Sylvia. Tremendous.
So good. But when I was researching this, I saw that The Cribs and Lee Ronaldo kind of hooked up again through Zoom to perform the song live. Did you watch that by any chance, Craig?
No, I haven't seen it. I'm going to check it out.
It's good. Like, it's not the best kind of live performance. Obviously, well,
maybe
it's very
I won't check it out.
No, it is good. Do check it out. Like, they're in four different locations, so it's kind of, you can see how those kind of things are difficult to sync up, but it's really cute from the perspective that the drummer Ross Jarman, his little son, who's about like 7 or 8, is playing like a mini drum kit beside him and like kind of keeping time and has really good shape. It's really nice. But yeah, I just think that this song is so impactful, it's so affecting, even though Ronaldo is just kind of stream of consciousness style, you know, picking out like various different images throughout the song and various kind of ills of the modern world throughout it.
Yeah.
I think it's just one of those songs that, like, even though it's 15 years old now, it still remains so kind of pertinent. And I can imagine if my niece, who's like, okay, maybe not if she's 12 now, maybe when she's like 14 or 15, I could imagine it would still have a similar kind of resonating kind of factor with someone of that kind of period in their life. And I just think it's such a cool collaboration, very unexpected, and just worked so well.
Good lads, and just represent all the right stuff. And I've betrayed myself because I could have picked this as my number one and been all like DIY and counterculture, and I went for something from the 80s that is kind of slick, and it's just a rich rock star musing over some tasteful 80s production. But this is my number one because it's just so ruddy, bloody, evocative.
I followed the sound of a jukebox coming from up the levee. All of a sudden, I could hear somebody whistling from right behind me. I turned around and she said, "Why do you always end up down at Nick's Cafe?" I said, "I don't know. The wind just kind of pushed me this
said, hang the rich.
So Craig.
Oh man, so Craig. Yeah, if it wasn't about a river, it could almost be yacht rock. I don't know if you can have a yacht on a river. Maybe you can. It's Robbie Robertson. It's somewhere down the crazy river. And yeah, like I was nearly going to go for maybe Eels, Susan's House or something. One of those. I like those kind of journeying tracks where it's spoken word, but this kind of like the whiskey and cigar voice, Love is Intonation. I'm not really a big fan of the band. Like I like some of their stuff, but I wouldn't put them on as much as I listened to this song. It was Robbie Robertson's first solo album. It was like 1987. He was working with like Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno was knocking about. And the song is basically...
Old Serapus.
Lanois was talking about it. He's like, Robbie was basically just describing hanging out in like Arkansas or Kansas, as Lana Del Rey would say, with Levon Helm and just like talking about hot nights and fishing with dynamite. I'm just like, okay, grand. And like asking someone for directions for someplace somewhere down the crazy river. But Daniel Lanois says he presented Robbie Robertson in the studio with this thing Brian Eno introduced him to, which was the Suzuki Omnicord. It's like an electric auto harp, and they were messing around with this. And as they were messing around with it, Robbie Robertson just started like doing these words over it, like in the booth.
Oh my god!
And it's like it reminds me of like what Bon Iver has been trying to do on his last two albums, but it's like steamier and kind of filtered through like Hemingway or something, kind of grizzled. And yeah, it's just it's really great. It's a really kind of luxurious, cool, evocative listen. And yeah,
it's one of the sleaziest sounding songs I've heard in a long time.
Yeah,
it's so sleazy.
wistful, right?
It's definitely as well very like swampy. Like I've also just
you
kind of
feel
done
the heat.
A rewatch. Yeah, definitely. Like it's sweaty. Like I've just done a rewatch of season one of True Detective, and I can imagine.
Oh yeah.
Rust, like I can imagine Rust and Marty like venturing into like a bar as one of their kind of like missions that they have to do to like solve the murder or whatever, and like Robbie Robertson is just there on the stage singing this song in the background. Like it's so good. It's just the right amount of 80s cheese and I love it.
Yeah, like I think he just finished doing the soundtrack to The Color of Money, which is perfect. Like, so.
Oh my gosh, yeah. so good. I had never heard that song before, so Craig, again, thank you so much for broadening my horizons. Okay, will we wrap this thing up? And
yeah,
do you want to hear
I'm
my
excited.
Number one?
Let's do it.
Do you want to hear a song that traumatized me emotionally again as a 15-year-old girl?
Yeah, let's do it. If it's going to be okay, it's not going to bring up old pain. Notes.
I think this song will like perpetually traumatize me emotionally.
Okay, let's do it. Let's power
let's,
through.
Let's
We're
go
all here
for it.
For you.
Let's go to that place.
You know something funny? I forgot that boy right away. Instead, I remember being tucked in bed and hearing my mama say, "Hush, little baby." Was I Can Never Go Home Anymore by the Shangri-Las, a group that I became absolutely obsessed with when I was about 16.
Wow.
And I had a massive 60s girl group phase, and the Shangri-Las were kind of the leading light in it. Obviously, the songs just steered by teen tragedies and melodramas. At the time, I found them really entertaining, kind of almost like these radio novella kind of teleplays. I just found them a really fascinating song kind of structure. At that time, I'd never heard anything like that before. And I remember hearing this song for the first time and just being absolutely just like guilt addled for the character in that song, kind of betraying and kind of going against that mother-daughter relationship for
a stupid boy. obviously, the Shangri-Las, they were kind of big between like 1964 and 1966. Hugely influential on bands like the New York Dolls, the Jesus and Mary Chain, Blondie, and obviously Amy Winehouse. When I was going through this song in particular, I couldn't help but notice like the influence that this song in particular had on, say, like Back to Black for her. There's not really a whole lot of lore about the Shangri-Las online.
Okay.
Their kind of flame kind of burned bright and then it kind of burned quick. A lot of the members, so the members were Mary Weiss, Betty Weiss, who were sisters, and then there was identical twins, Margie Ganser and Marianne Ganser. And they just kind of played at school shows, talent shows, and they garnered the attention of like a kind of local record label. They performed without a name. They got their name from like a local restaurant in Queens. But what kind of set them apart from, say, like, you know, the Ronettes or the Shirelles or even like Diana Ross and the Supremes is that because they were from Queens and people associated Queens with being like quite rough and quite a rough neighborhood in New York, the Shangri-Las immediately had this like tough girl kind of label attached to them. And there's loads of different kind of, you know, rumors surrounding them. Like there was one that Mary apparently attracted the FBI because she had a firearm across, you know, state lines. And she just said, yeah, of course I had a pistol in my hotel room to like protect myself against people, which is kind of grim in itself to think about. They were all basically minors when they were in the band. They were all under 18. When they were recording this song as well, Mary was saying how she had not been speaking to her mother for a few years at that point, and when she was in the studio recording the song, she was absolutely in bits crying. So yeah, I think the Shangri-Las, again, if they're a band that you haven't really gotten into, they're phenomenal. They're so great. And yeah, they're kind of one of those enduring acts that always kind of seem to fit a mood no matter what mood you're in.
Interesting. I'm glad they kind of popped up, because I was thinking like Leader of the Pack just feels like the proto version of this whole little genre that we're talking about. So great to give them a shout out. And also, you know, a nice kind of like coming full circle with the tone, considering the show started with like Dead Wasps and you know, despairing Jedward. We've gone right back to the trauma to come full circle. Sarah, it's been quite the ride. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for joining Adam.
Well, thank you for having me.
Commiserations to Phil Daniels and Parklife. Just didn't make the cut. I also thought we might feature at some point Britney getting that ring that was thrown to the bottom of the ocean. There was some great 90s cheese, but alas, no, we went pretty respectable on this one. So really enjoyed it. Sarah, appreciate it. It was great having you on.
Thank you. It was
this
great to be here.
This episode of No Encore was engineered by the handsome Sonic Architect, the Choice Music Prize nominated Sonic Architect, that is Adam Shanahan. Dude, we love you. Good
what
to have you back.
The best.
As for you, listener, thanks for listening. And thanks for contributing to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/NoEncore, because you haven't actually gone there yet, have you? No worries. You don't have to. I'm just glad you stuck with us.
The neck.
Take care of yourselves. Don't give us any money if you don't want to. Just really, really appreciate you tuning in. We'll be back next week. Dave will be back next week. And I'm Craig Fitzpatrick. This is No Encore. Peace.
Before you go, there's something I want you to have.
Oh, it's beautiful. But wait a minute, isn't this?
Yeah, yes it is.
But I thought the old lady dropped it into the ocean in the air.
Well, baby, I went down and got it for you.
Aw, you shouldn't have. Oops, I...
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
Been thinking about McDonald's all day. Can't get it off my mind. I can already taste it. Ooh, got my mind on my mouth and my mouth ready for some Mickey D's deal.
There's a deal for every moment at McDonald's.
Right now, get two of your favorites for just $3.50. Mix and match a classic McChicken, a hot and spicy McChicken, or a juicy McDouble. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.